Welcome back to Sound Sessions here on WGN Radio. This is Michael and Kevin. So happy to be here. We're in for Brian Noonan tonight. And that beautiful sound you're hearing is by the one and only band, The Beatles. I don't know if you've heard of them.
Who?
The Beatles.
Oh.
We got a great guest coming up. Mr. Ronnie Schneider is going to be giving us the inside scoop on what's going on with the Rolling Stones and the Beatles. Great historian, great music mind. He's the author of Out of Our Heads, The Rolling Stones, The Beatles, and Me. He's actually worked with some of the biggest names in show business, including the Rolling Stones, the Beatles, Sam Cooke, Neil Sedaka, Bobby Vinton. He also produced the 1970 documentary Gimme Shelter, which we talked about a little bit earlier, that chronicled the last weeks of the Rolling Stones' 1969 U.S. tour. And we have Ronnie on the phone. Ronnie, what's going on, man? Welcome to Sound Sessions.
Well, I'm here, so that's a good start. How are you?
We're doing well. We're doing very well.
We're doing great. So, you know, you had this extraordinary life. Where did this start? What were your humble beginnings to get to work with such legendary musicians like the Rolling Stones and the Beatles?
Well, being a boring accountant, I was going to the University of Miami. And during the summers, my mother said, why don't you experience accounting work by going up and staying with my Uncle Alan Klein. So my Uncle Alan Klein was the guy that originally had Sam Cooke, Neil Sedaka, and all those people. So I would go up in the summers and do accounting work for those groups. And then actually in 1965, when I graduated, I was dancing to Satisfaction, and I went into New York, and my uncle said, I just signed this group, the Rolling Stones. Go on the road with them and represent me in the box office. And that's how it really started.
My gosh, what a cool kismet kind of thing if you're going to just, you know, be a young kid who's just in accounting and you get to go on tour with
all of a sudden, Rolling Stones. Right.
It's like that movie with Cameron, what's that?
Almost Famous.
Almost Famous, that's right.
Yeah, people always tell me that. The only difference in all that was the fact that I didn't care about any of that stuff. and when I went in, the advantage was the boys were the same age as me, us boys. And so we all related. And it was a different kind of case because I was like a crazy accountant. So that was the advantage I had with them. And once again, with the Stones, it was a case of guys that were just so, when we went on the road together, we just hung out together. And that's where we started to relate and it turned out quite nice.
So you talk about that. You guys are just hanging out. Like, is there any kind of behind the scenes? I mean, can you speak to, like, were these guys just regular guys? Or, I mean, were they living this lavish?
That's what it is. Yeah, sorry to jump on you.
No.
That's what it is. What people don't understand is they're all regular guys. The Stones, the Beatles, all of them, you know, Jefferson Airplane. Everybody's a regular guy. When they get together in the groups, the thing that makes the difference, I think, is the creative talent. And the music comes out. I would sit in the studios and listen to the Stones, and it wouldn't be just one guy going in and doing something. It would be each guy would contribute. Brian would do something. Bill would do something. Mick. So the end result was it was this thing that would build with all these little pieces, and then at the end of the day, or probably usually a couple of weeks, you'd hear this amazing song come out of them. And nobody ever knew for sure what it was, but, you know, you had that feeling. I would sit there and listen to them. They'd try and get my opinion. I'd never give it, but the stuff was amazing.
Wow. You know, it was such an interesting climate, too, at that time. In the 1960s, music was changing, the country was changing, the world, basically, was a whole new place. But that 1960s phrase that kind of always stuck around, that sex, drugs, and rock and roll really, really, you know, bit through that core of music. It was a really accurate summary of what went on. Could you explain, you know, how that came to be? What was it like living during that time?
Well, right now is a magic time because, like, they're celebrating the release of Sgt. Pepper.
50 years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's 50-year anniversary of that right now. God, who believes that?
Right.
And it was also the time that the Stones were competing with their satanic majesties. So, in the sense that I lost the trend because I was trying to think. I'm thinking of those moments when it was like the Beatles did this magic music with that stuff and drugs were taking over, and here Sgt. Pepper looked fantastic, which I consider the Beatles did it on a buzz, and then when you listen to their Satanic Majesties, it was more like a hangover. The Stones weren't in a good place at that time, so I always think of that in a little special way because the Stones were all upset, the drug busts, speaking of sex, drugs, and rock and roll. It was always the rock and roll for both groups was more important than anything else. The byproducts, of course, were sex and drugs, which, you know, come on, it's fun.
Oh, yeah.
And it was the summer of love. So, like I said, it was a case where all us short, ugly people had a chance to finally celebrate sex.
Well, I want to know, you know, with these guys, the Beatles and the Stones kind of putting out music, you know, at different, well, I guess kind of in the same era.
Mm-hmm.
What was the relationship between the two bands? Were they friendly or was it like competitive?
It's always a friendly competition. Realize the Beatles gave the Rolling Stones their first song, I Want to Be Your Man.
Mm.
So, you know, it was always the friendly. Everybody looked at everybody else. They envied each other. I think Mick wanted to be one of them. You know, Paul wanted to be another. You know, they would be the bad guy, the good guys. You know, so they all had this impression. Like I said, here we had Sgt. Pepper, which is all pretty and clean. And then you have Satanic Majesties. So that was, they both played against what they were represented to be. But none of them took it seriously.
Mm-hmm.
They never paid attention to the press. And that's why I think they all survive.
Yeah.
It's people that tried to live up to what people expected of them that burned themselves out.
Hey, Ronnie, are you okay on time? We want to take a quick break and come back to you. Does that work for you?
I think so. So far, I'm doing great. I love talking. It makes sure I'm still alive.
All right, everybody, give us a call. And we would love to hear, you know, your past memories with the Rolling Stones or Beatles and seeing what it's like. If you had any celebrity run-ins with them also, too, or if you have any, you know, the first time you heard them, it'd be great to hear from you. So call us or text us if you don't want to be on air. 312-981-7200. But we're putting the call out. Let's talk some Beatles and Rolling Stones.
Absolutely. So, yeah, you were listening to Sound Sessions on WGN Radio. We're talking with Ronnie Schneider about the Beatles and the Stones and his relationship with them. We're going to take a quick break and come back with more Sound Sessions here on WGN.
Welcome back to Sound Sessions here on WGN Radio. This is Michael and Kevin. You can call in anytime, 312-981-7200. Text in, same number, 312-981-7200. You can find us on Sound Sessions. Search us on Facebook. You can find us on WGNRadio.com.
We're all over the place.
We are. But speaking about all over the place, we have two of the greatest bands of all time that we've been discussing with our good friend Ronnie Schneider, who's the author of Out of Our Heads, The Rolling Stones, The Beatles, and Me. And we kind of left off, Ronnie, on the fact, you know, that the climate was changing in the 60s and these bands were coming to life, but at the same time, like staying very grounded. You know, what was the climate like in the studio? Did you ever get a chance to see those creative juices flowing when you were working with them?
Oh, absolutely. I was in the studio with them, and it's interesting when you're just a person who doesn't know anything about it. It could be one of the most boring things in the world because you just sit there, and it's the creative process, which is very ugly usually.
Mm-hmm.
But with the Stones, it would usually begin about 1 o'clock in the morning. So it was always a late process. Yeah, well, they'd get in, you'd go into the studio, and it's like everybody getting organized, getting into a place, and I think it's probably like writers, and also you're trying to get creative. And it's getting, adding, doing it with the details, setting up the speakers, setting up microphones. So all in all, I was in studios with both groups. But the thing that I can sit there and say that made it worthwhile is, like I said, they'd maybe be in a little separate cubicle by themselves. But I could watch as each person added that little thing I spoke of earlier.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, you'd be just sitting there, and then it comes to a crescendo with also the help of the engineers and the producers and all that. It's a group effort. It's like any team sport. The end result is you get this music that lasts forever, which is what I think makes it all magic.
You know, and it's interesting, too.
I want to give you a little background. I wanted to tell you one little thing about you when you were asking about growing up with these things. Let me ask you what you would think of it. You're a little kid from Miami. You go on the road with these guys, the Rolling Stones. You're not impressed by celebrity. It doesn't matter. And at the end of the tour, you also room with this other guy, the photographer, Garrett Mankiewicz. The end of the tour, this Keith Richards, who's an amazing musician, everybody obviously respects him, comes over and says, "Hey, guys, you want to go horseback riding with me over the weekend? We'll get horses. We'll camp out." And luckily, Garrett took these pictures, and we went and rented guns and all. But the one point I wanted to make is, as Garrett said, he said, "You know, you look at these pictures, and you and I look like these two old Jewish guys, and Keith Richards looks like Billy the Kid."
That's such a cool story. I mean, it's such a weird, like, that's such an, you know, you want to go horseback riding? I don't picture a rock star. You know, that's such a bizarre but hilariously awesome story. That's great.
Yeah, with Keith Richards, too, who is one of those legendary, like, party animals of all time. And he's just like, yo, let's go on the Stallions.
Well, Ronnie, going back to the studio, I want to touch on, too, I mean, the Beatles are credited, in some of their recordings, are credited with a lot of, like, innovation that kind of still lasts in recording today, such as, like, feedback and other things. Mm-hmm, I mean... Mm-hmm.
Reverse recordings and you know, oh man, just so many great solos that come from sounds that aren't even real things, like birds chirping and stuff like that was not seen before.
So, I mean, can you speak to the innovation at all that was going on?
Well, I'm an accountant, not a musical engineer.
Sure.
All I can tell you is I was around and I heard what everybody was saying about it. Let's do it that way. You know, like all these greats were analyzing it. The end result was Sergeant Pepper was just amazingly creative. I mean, talking as the accountant also made a lot of money, but it was also, when you think of all the songs and the way they look, I always thought that Sergeant Pepper had to be a cultural effect on all of us. Because up until that, you know, in the 50s, all the kids were wearing suits, it was all these other. Now the Beatles gave everybody permission to do acid and dress like an idiot. So it was like you'd watch on King's Road in London, you watch people strolling around, but you could do what you wanted to do. It brought about individuality, but all these individuals wanted to be hippies and, you know, wild psychedelics. So I think the culture really changed during that time, which is what you brought up. And meanwhile, the Stones were, you know, Keith was coming out with riffs that get you through your bones. You
yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Man.
So that was what I could say about the music, you know.
Sure.
What a great creative time. And, you know, when they were putting these albums together, a lot of people, you know, when I was growing up, the first albums that I ever heard in my life were with my dad, and we'd listen to Sgt. Pepper's, or we'd listen to, you know, the Rolling Stones or Cat Stevens or something like that. And these records that they created really, you know, kind of influenced my life. I mean, I wouldn't be into music the way I am now if it wasn't for those early times. We actually have a caller right now who had a quick question about the Beatles albums. John, welcome to Sound Sessions. What's going on, man?
This is a great show. I love this topic. It's a pleasure to talk to all of you.
Thank you.
Yeah, I've got two questions. One has to do with the album Rubber Soul. Apparently, not one cut on that album was ever a 45 or released as a 45. For whatever reason, I wonder if you know the story behind that. And then, of course, this the other song, Michelle, written by McCartney, was given to Jonathan and David. They made it the hit. And I'm wondering what album that is on by McCartney, if it even is. So I'll stop and listen.
Thank you, John.
Well, if you're looking to me to answer that, I don't have one. The only thing I can tell you about Rubber Soul was for the longest time, it was my favorite album.
Mm-hmm.
I just thought Norwegian Wood and all that, so I didn't get into the detail, and I'm not one of the musicologists that goes through all of that stuff. I can just relate to my experiences with them and the appreciation I had for the music that they were creating.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. You know, it sounded pretty good, didn't it?
Yeah, that was good. You pulled it off.
That did. And you know what happened? A little bit of the small bit of music knowledge I have about the Beatles, when they were putting out these albums, a lot of the time it came out in two different retrospects. Like, so you'd get the British album version, and then they'd translate it over to the American version, because they were making so much money at that time. They were putting the same kind of songs in two different albums with two different covers, and they were making just twice as much. So maybe that had something to do with the fact that never came out as a 45. You know, there was a lot of inner workings with these albums, which may help explain it a little bit. But yeah, all in all, great, great album. I mean,
yeah.
Fantastic.
Well, I can tell you another thing, though. Knowing the record companies were trying to sell albums. They didn't want to sell singles.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, once again, they would keep all the songs. Remember, it was hard enough to get them to do EPs.
Mm-hmm.
That was the complaint. That's what brought about the other big revolution, about people were just sick and tired of buying albums to get a single. So, you know, that's the only point I can make on that part.
Ronnie, I want to know...
Wait, I will give you... I'll give you
no,
one
go ahead.
Other little inside.
Yeah.
On the Stones at this time with Satanic Majesties. When they were recording that, they did a song, 2,000 Light Years from Home, if I remember. Anyhow, that song, I was on.
No kidding.
No way.
You know, what happened was the Stones were, they were trying to get special weird sounds. It was supposed to be psychedelic sounds, universe, you know, traveling in space. And I've got a very weird voice, as you can tell. And they said, everybody, go sit around a microphone. They put us in a little room around a microphone. There were a few of us sitting on the ground and standing. And they said, okay, let's make some sounds. When you were talking about the creative process and the music, yeah, they said, make some sounds. And some of my sounds was me screeching my voice out.
I'll have to listen for that. Listen closely.
I'm going to listen like a bird for that. That's going to be great.
Right.
So, Ronnie, real quick, we're almost out of time here, but I want to know,
yes.
I mean, if you were around or if you had any insight on the breakup of the band, the Beatles.
Yes, I do, and I can tell you right now, number one, Yoko had nothing to do with it.
Okay, see, I was going to ask.
Get out of town.
Yeah.
Okay.
No, there's two big things that I'm aware of that the rest of the world has wrong. One, number one, the Rolling Stones, of which I was involved, never hired the Hells Angels, and Yoko didn't break up the Beatles. It just seems the press likes to have something to go on. I'd been with John and Yoko many times, and John would give me about 1,000 brilliant ideas every 2 seconds. I'd say, just one a day, John, please, one a day. But he'd keep rattling on. And while he'd be talking, every now and then, Yoko would come over to say something to jump in. And as opposed to being a guy who's kowtowed to this other person, he basically would say, shut up, which was embarrassing at the time. But it was John was saying, hey, I'm making a point. Don't interrupt me. And so that was that point. So, you know, that's what I could tell you. The breakup was because it was like any group of guys, time, things, life changes and all that. It was a divorce. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure right now if they were all still alive, they'd be together because they wouldn't let the Rolling Stones be out on the road alone.
Yeah,
that is a beautiful, beautiful thing. Before you go, we have about 30 seconds here. I got to know, what was the story behind the Hells Angels with Rolling Stones? Because Rolling Stones, they have a great thing going on. They have a great connection to Chicago with Chess Records, and they have the Rolling Stones exhibitionism at Navy Pier right now. But I got to know, that's such a classic story. What was the story behind that?
Well, by the way, I was supposed to be there for the exit. Well, the classic story behind it is the Stones were in Muscle Shoals recording till the day before the concert. I got there 2 days before the concert. Everything was organized by the Grateful Dead and all the people over in that group, Rock Scully, that whole entourage. They organized it like they usually did always in San Francisco. The Hells Angels always came to the events and guarded the generators. They were allowed to stay around the stage because they guarded the generators. You can't hire the Hells Angels. What happens is the people in Altamont wanted to have this big event and get their name on the you know, everybody's radar. And when we go to do it, and all of a sudden it turns out this guy's murdered. Well, it's self-defense. When the guy's killed there, everybody's scared. What are we going to do? You can't blame it on the Grateful Dead, all those people there. So what do? They blame it on those Brits. They're leaving town anyhow.
Jeez.
So if you think about it logically, number one, the other two things, as I'm jumping quickly, the other two things is the event was put on by not me and not by the Rolling Stones. When I was asked to sign for the event, I said no. I didn't want to be legally obligated. And instead, we heard from a voice in the back, I'll sign, and that was John James, who turned out to be a giant con man that nearly got me killed. John James signed for it and the event. So the end result was any legal world would look at that whole thing. The Stones were invited to come play for free. They agreed to do a nice, good event. And as the saying goes, no good deed
goes unpunished.
That's so true. Hey, that's Ronnie Schneider. Ronnie, I could talk to you for the next like 6 days, but it's been a great pleasure talking to you. Thank you so much for joining us here on Sound Sessions.
My pleasure, gentlemen.
Let's keep in touch.